Blog Talk Radio.
Thank you, Brother Robinson. Hotep family,
in America, the Caribbean, Africa, the Middle East, Central America, and South America. It's a privilege to be on the show today and share this information with you. The situation has been going on down here in Richmond for several years, actually.
Sister Nomi, let me stop you for a second for our listening audience. And I want you to just give our people just a little backdrop of who you are, a little bit of history of you, you know, as an organizer, as a sister on the front line. Brother Africa, why don't you tell his audience, who are Sister Nomi?
Well, I've been living in Richmond, Virginia since 2000. I've been working in the school system and in various businesses. I'm just a conscious person that, you know, believes in, you know, black people being given the respect that we deserve. I'm mother of a recent college graduate, and I'm just concerned with education, primarily, of our young people, and also the preservation of our history here in Richmond.
The preservation of our history. That says it like, sister. What is going on in Richmond, Virginia right now, from your perspective? What
okay, the real hot potato issue is Shaco Bottom. Shaco Bottom is an area down around 18th Street, from Broad all the way back down to the river, and it's an area where for many, many years in the early 19th century, Richmond was the second largest slave trading post in the United States behind New Orleans. The slave trade was horrendous here. You know, people were marched from Manchester Docks, where the river is, all into the city at night undercover and put into slave houses and jails and pens to await a horrible fate of being shipped out into the South, you know, down into the southern states of North Carolina, South Carolina, Tennessee, you know, Texas, to live a miserable life of servitude with no respect for their family. Family members were separated, mothers from daughters, sons from fathers. It was just a horrible, horrible experience. And they've been trying to cover it up. And for many years, the burial grounds where a lot of our ancestors were placed had been paved over, you know, with asphalt, and cars were parked there, you know, courtesy of Virginia Commonwealth University. And then a fight went on to unearth that so that, you know, the resting place could be a resting place instead of a parking lot. But ever since November, and even before that, they've been talking about building a stadium down there on top of the place where 165 slave auction houses were built, where people died and were tortured and jailed and shipped out, as if that never even happened. So there's been a concentrated effort by many people in the community, both black and white, to stop this, you know, because tax dollars would be spent to put a stadium and other things on top of our ancestors' remains. It's a very disgraceful situation because, you know, how could you put a recreational playground on top of a cemetery? That's what it really boils down to. And many, many people have been coming out to community meetings, to city council meetings, and a lot has been said, and especially in a very well-known paper in Richmond called the Virginia Defender about the situation. And most recently, the true story of why this is happening has come out. And it's really all about money. It's about these rich white developers downtown deciding that they're going to build more, lofts and condos and such at the expense of the taxpayers. It's similar to what happened with the Washington Redskins last year about how they, you know, they made an agreement with Bond Secure to take that land that was behind DMV, you know, and build this, you know, facility for the Washington Redskins, but the people of Richmond actually paid for that, you know, and what are they getting for that, you know? It's just business as usual. The people who, you know, financially run the city are making these decisions, but this time, as far as Shaco Bottom is concerned, the people came out, and the people reacted, and the people voiced their opinions as to why they didn't want this to happen. It was almost like saying enough is enough. You know, we all been doing things for a long time, but this time when you start talking about dishonoring our ancestors, we have to come forward and we have to make a stand. And the funniest part of the story is that the mayor of Richmond is a black man. And it's hard for us to believe that a black man.
You said an African male is taking a position against the issue that y'all are raising. That's what you're telling the people?
That's what I'm saying, believe it or not. In fact, he's a minister at a well-known church here in Richmond on Hall Street. I guess that's the reason why a lot of people say that, you know, religion and politics don't match. Because how can someone who says that he believes in God and he's the head of a church, you know, a well-known church, and he's the mayor, actually not believe in the spirituality question behind the whole situation? You know, any culture has the right to honor their ancestors. And here's a black man who's probably has some relatives way back that is buried down there in Shaco Bottom, like most of us do, since so many of our people came through Richmond on the way to other parts of slavery throughout the South. And he's backing it. He's like, you know, what's the problem? You know, we're trying to do something that's going to create jobs. We're trying to do something that's going to move Richmond forward. We're trying to do something that's going to put Richmond on the map. But at what expense? Why would you want to build a stadium on top of a graveyard? That's the question. What person, you know, of conscious and spiritual would want to do something like that, desecrate your ancestors? He had to know that that would, you know, rub people the wrong way. You know, it's important for us to remember that beyond money, if we don't have any sense of our history and our culture, we're nothing. You know, we can't, how can you justify, you know, trying to do something to make money when it's going to hurt, you know, your own people and your own people's conception of their past? You have to relate to your past in order to know what direction that you're going into. And this slavery thing here in Richmond is a serious, serious issue, and we can't gloss over it. We can't act like it never happened, because a lot of the ramifications of how it divided us up as families and how it divided us into different groups and we can't unite is because of what happened down there in Shaco Bottom. And, you know, people are not, you know, taking it lightly. People are keeping their eyes on what's going on. They're keeping their eyes on City Hall. They're keeping their eyes on the mayor. And they're not going to let it go by. It's a real serious issue here in Richmond.
Okay, let me ask you this question so our listening audience can get somewhat a visual perspective or perception on this area we call the Shaco Bottom, or Shaco Slip, some of them call it. What is the makeup of the clientele who own businesses down there, and what is the makeup of the clientele who normally go down in the area? What has been the historical? You talk about it a little bit, about the historical aspect of it, but in terms of the clientele itself, what is the makeup of the people and the businesses? What is that?
Okay,
makeup?
Well, Shaco Bottom is basically, I would say, a tourist area, and it's made up of a lot of restaurants, and nightclubs and, you know, stores, you know, some stores that sell, like, surfboards and jewelry and different things. You know, it's where people go to have a good time. A lot of the, you know, VCU students and other students, you know, if you go down there on Friday and Saturday nights, that's basically who's down there. As far as businesses are concerned, historically there's always been black businesses down there, but and there's still a few black businesses down there now, but it's not many. You know, our people in general, except for the younger people, don't basically go down there. You know, it's always been kind of, in a lot of older people's mind, I would say people that have lived in Richmond most of their lives, maybe 40 and above, almost look at it almost like being a spooky place to be. You know, there's always been a, well, there hasn't always been, but of late there's been a marketplace where people go and sell things, and that's been on the upswing for the last couple of years, especially with the revival of Amtrak Station. You know, but, you know, years in years past, it's been a place where people could go and get fresh food and, you know, baked goods and, you know, different things that people bring in from the country and other places.
Let me stop you, Namia. What is the racial tension between the Africans and the Europeans? Is there an area where African people are treated with dignity and feel comfortable going down there? Because Richmond has certain geographic areas where it's still based upon race, where people are congregating around. What is your take on that?
Well, to be honest with you, most of the young people down there, they don't care because they're like college age and young and, you know, like anywhere between 17 and 30, they kind of intermingle with each other. So the race, I don't think race is a problem for them. But for some of the, you know, the older blacks that, you know, they don't feel comfortable coming down there. I'm not sure if they've actually felt animosity from people who, you know, own businesses or whatever. But generally, they don't really come down there. If they come, say, like if they come to a Sweet Tea or Addie Abba's, they basically go to that business and then they leave. It's not like they really mill around and intermingle and stuff like that. They don't especially feel comfortable, you know, in that area, like they would if they were on Broad Street or maybe, you know, in some other part of the city. But, you know, basically a lot of older people, say, you know, 35 and up, they don't really go down there and hang out. You know, you mostly find younger people who a lot of times are not, you know, conscious of history or conscious of, you know, different things that go on in the city, and they just, you know, they want to go down there and drink and have a good time. That's basically what it's about down there. It's just drinking, hanging out, meeting other people, and having a good time. Sometimes it gets to be extreme, but, you know, it is what it is.
Okay, Sister Namia, in terms of the forces who want to be a baseball stadium over this African Ancestors Cemetery or site, who are the players who want this proposal to build a stadium? Who's
okay,
behind
Okay, well,
all
you have several players, you know. Like I said, it's a big spread in the Virginia Defender this week about it. You have Jack Berry, who's the executive director of Venture Richmond, you know, and then you have Mayor Dwight Jones, who's the president of Venture Richmond, who, like I said, is the minister and the mayor, but he's pushing this full force. You have Kim Shearer, who is the president and CEO of the Greater Richmond Chamber of Commerce, which is made up of all your big business people all over, you know, Richmond. You have the Alliance Group, you know, which is a public relations outfit hired by Venture Richmond to build support for the stadium. And then you have Solomonsky, H. Louise Solomonsky, you know, who's kind of like in the background, but he's a billionaire, and, you know, he has a lot of money invested in real estate down there. And it's really a rich man's game, you know, and they're not concerned about the, you know, the, about the, about the, about the graveyard. They're not concerned about that. They're just looking at things in terms of dollars and cents. And recently, we have a sister that they call Miss Community, and her name is Clovia Lawrence, and they got her to promote the stadium, and she's a black woman. She's a well-known radio personality because she claims it's going to bring out all of these jobs and people are going to be able to be gainfully employed. You know, but when you think about a supermarket and you think about a hotel and a parking lot, you know, these are not, you know, these are not big shot jobs they're talking about, if they're even talking about really hiring so many people for these jobs, you know. The point is, it doesn't matter what is to be gained from this. It's wrong. It's just plain old wrong to put a baseball stadium on top of a graveyard. It's just, it's a historic site. It's not just Africans that have history down there. It's the Quakers that have history. It's Jewish community that have history. It's other people. And their story needs to be told as well. You know, the only thing that really needs to be down there is a sacred ground memorial park, which can tell a story of what really went on down there, not a baseball stadium.
There's definitely strong compassion for the Africans in terms of the issue. It seems like it's a question of respect, respecting them as historically as a people in their history. There seems to be a great zeal in terms of that direction. But let me just raise this question with you, and I'd like for you to give me your response. Isn't that the same area also that has a large Jewish museum, Holocaust museum down there, and there were no kind of issues
Absolutely.
In opposition to that? So
That's
why
right.
is such a why is it an issue of insensitivity when it comes to African people? What kind of statement are they saying to African people with this issue?
Well, it's they're basically saying that our history doesn't count, and they don't really want to. They don't want the world to really understand what really went on down in Shaco Bottom. They don't want to know that the mentality of the people that lived during this time and enslaved innocent people and brought them all the way from across the ocean for just economic reasons. It was all about money. It's what built Richmond. Every industry that you can think of in this city benefited from slavery, whether it was transportation, whether it was the banking, whether it was the insurance, whatever you can think of that made money benefited from slavery. They don't want that story to be told. A lot of people feel like, oh, that was ancient history. That's not important. That wasn't that long ago. Slavery was over in 1865. That wasn't that long ago. People feel as if we should just forget about it, you know, and move on. But you can't move on from something like this. This is too important, and the story needs to be told, and people need to understand that people have a right to tell their story. People have a right to know their history. A lot of these young people now, you know, based on the school system that we have here in Richmond, they don't even understand anything about slavery. They're not really teaching it in the school system. It's like it never almost, for a lot of young people, when you start talking about, Harriet Tubman, and you start talking about Frederick Douglass, and you start talking about Sojourner Truth, they don't even know who they are. And some of them in high school, because they haven't really been taught. You know, and unfortunately, some of our parents feel that that's not important. They feel like this is 2014, you know, it's all about the computer, it's all about this and that. But the people that don't know their history are doomed to repeat it. That's what it is. It's just like that, you know. So it's important for that story of Shaco Bottom to be told. It's important for us to have a place where we can go and commune with our ancestors. If you go down to Shaco Bottom right now, as big as that parking lot is, because I've been down there several times myself, they only have like 4 or 5 parking spaces that are allocated to people who want to just come and look at the Winfrey Cottage, that want to look at Lumpkin Jail, and want to look at the cemetery. Of all the parking spaces in that area, that's all they have.
When you said lump in jail, explain that significant to our audience as relates to African people in this question of enslavement.
Well, Lumpkin's Jail was one of many jails that they had down there, and it was a place where they would put one of our ancestors that was enslaved to, if they were unruly, or they would just put them in there if they were on their way to be transported the next day or the day after. But it was a terrible place, and really, there's nothing there. We just know that that's part of the, you know, archaeological, you know, site where it actually was, because most of that stuff has been buried underground over time, you know. But it's a significant place because, you know, a lot of things went on down there. It's like a symbol of the many jails that was in that area. You know, it was just part of that horrible process that people had to go through on their way somewhere else.
Now, Sister Namia, it's my understanding in terms of we're talking about proposing this stadium to be built in the area in terms of how it can be financed. It's my understanding that the citizens of Richmond, a lot of their money will come from them. And part of the contradiction that one may view in this particular issue is that why would they fund this stadium with public money? Well, at the same time, they already have a city stadium up on the boulevard and it's not really properly being used. So can you speak to that contradiction?
Okay, well, the stadium on the boulevard is basically soundly made. It needs renovation, but there's another company that's willing to come in and renovate the stadium as it is, which I think is a much better idea. Because when you have that flooding down there, you know, during the rains and stuff in that area, it's not pleasant. People don't want to be sloshing around while they're trying to play baseball. It's a flood zone, you know, and it would cost a whole lot of money to clean that up before they even began to build the stadium. But people that are coming from out of town, it's convenient for them to get off of the highway and just go right there on the boulevard. So why not fix up what's already there? You know, especially if you have someone that has a good plan to do that, you know, like a private development plans on doing that. You know, that money that they take to build that stadium, why don't they take that money and fix these schools? In the last couple of years, it has been a travesty about how the ceilings have been falling down, how the bathrooms are in ill repair, how there's such a big dichotomy between the resources that they have in Richmond Public School as opposed to on RICO schools, as opposed to Chesterfield schools, where they are really taking their money in these areas and building their schools up and giving their children the resources that they need to learn. To me, this is more important, educating a generation to go forward into the future rather than worrying about a double-A baseball stadium that will only be used a couple of months out of the year. Why are they making such a big deal about an institution that's only been used a couple of months out of the year? Why are they willing to put that kind of money into it? You know, the city the city council has pledged a certain amount of money. The state assembly has pledged a certain amount of money. But that private money that they're talking about for this plan, they haven't even started really talking about who's going to do it or how it's going to be raised or anything. It's just the mayor trying to rush this thing forward, you know, as if people are not looking and people are not listening and people are not aware of what's really going on.
Well, Sister Namia, we're going to stop you right there. We're going to tell you to stay on the line. We have various subject topics that we're going to talk about in different cities. Later on in the program, we'll open up our phone lines to our audience where they can speak to our guests as well as any issues they may have. So what we're going to do right now, we're going to pause for the calls, and when we come back, we're going to have Sister Sandy. We're going to talk a little bit about an issue that deal with us internationally in our relationship, and that issue is Cuba. So, everybody, you all listen to Africa on the Move with Brother Africa. We're going to pause for the calls. When we come back, we're going to talk a little bit about Cuba, which recently, yesterday, had it celebrate its Independence Day. So we'll be right back in about 2 minutes. That's Paul for a cause.
Africa, the center of the world. Latitude zero, longitude zero. Planned by the Creator. The Xanthropus was the first man found on the earth. That earth was the motherland. We know that without total understanding of what happened in the past, it would be difficult to relate to the future. We know that within the structure of the music, there should be a message, and the message should be truth. So now, we give you Africa, the center of the world.
Yes, center of the world is Africa. Africa is the nucleus of this whole world. It makes everything run. That's right, center of the world is Africa. We are back on Africa on the Move. You're listening to Brother African. And right now we can go to our next guest, Sister Sandy Waters. She is an organizer. She's a filmmaker. She's a photographer. And we're going to talk to her a little bit about Cuba and her work dealing with Cuba. And right now, we'd like to bring our sister in, Sandy. Sister Sandy, welcome to Africa on the Move.
Oh, thank you very much. I appreciate that.
Good, good. Sister Sandy, one thing we want to do for our listening audience, can you just tell us just a little bit about who you are and the things that you do around Cuba in terms of your work?
Okay, well, as you say, my name is Sandy Waters. I basically am a photographer and a filmmaker, and I'm very involved in the Cuba solidarity movement. My mom was Cuban, so I have a very blood relation to Cuba. I've been there several times. I have a big family that's still there. I have some here. So I got interested in Cuba because I was born here, so I really, you know, did not know about Cuba except through my mother's eyes, and she came here before the revolution, so I wanted to learn a lot about it. So that's basically how I started learning about it, pretty much been in solidarity ever since.
Okay, excellent. Sister Sandy, if I were going to ask you, why it's important for particular people in general, for African people in particular, to know about the real history and Cuban relationship to the African struggles here and abroad? Why is it important to know about what is Cuba and its historical relationship to us, just in general? What would be some of the things you say to our audience? Because everywhere I go, people have a tendency to have a misconception of Cuba based upon the U.S. propaganda. Can you speak to our people why you think Cuba is a real biblical country today and people to have a greater understanding and appreciation of who they are and what they have done.
Okay. Yeah, well, Cuba has done a lot of solidarity work all over the world, basically since the revolution in 1959, or really before then, 1953, when it began. Cuba has sent soldiers to fight against apartheid in South Africa. There's a lot that we don't know about. They fought on the right side of history. And they did not take anything out of Africa except for their dead comrades who were fighting to, you know, overthrow the apartheid system. And actually, once Nelson Mandela was released from prison, the first place he actually visited was Cuba. And I don't think a lot of people realize that either. They owe a big debt to Cuba. And other countries, Cuba has been in Africa helping, you know, to overthrow colonialism and sending doctors all over the world and training other doctors from third world countries for free to be doctors. So they do a lot of good in the world, and I don't think a lot of people know that.
Oh, excellent. In terms of some of the works that you have done, you say you're a filmmaker, a photographer. When you think about the images of Cuba, how does your work differ from how it has been presented here in the United States?
Okay. Well, I think I'm in a unique position, basically living here in Washington, D.C. I get to be around a lot of there's a lot of protests, of course, you know, a lot of civil disobedience, a lot of demonstrations, and a lot of things around Cuba. Maybe some people in other places in the country might not know about. And a lot of lobbying done here also. They have Cuba Days and, you know, and have different solidarity groups come here to D.C. to talk to their congressmen on the Hill and do other solidarity work in the city. And a lot of that I have been able to film throughout the years. Really, I've been doing it for more than 10 years. I have a lot of stuff going on about the Cuban Five and other Cuba work in the city. So I like to be able to document that in photos and in film, as well as cultural events about Cuba, the Cuban thing, you know, Cuban cultural and art and music that just, you know, happens to be here in D.C., in the D.C. area. A lot of things, I think, that go unnoticed. So I am basically working on a couple of documentaries. One is about the Cuban Five and another Cuban solidarity work in that area, and also just about Cuban, Afro-Cuban culture and music, and another one on family. So actually, I guess that's three, isn't it?
Okay, that's excellent. In terms of the Cuban Five, some of our audience may not be familiar. What is the Cuban Five and why this is so special? Give us your spin on who is the Cuban Five and why the people need to know who they are and how we maybe can help them.
Okay. Well, the Cuban Five were five comrades that were sent here from Cuba back in the 90s when there was a lot of terrorism, let's say terrorism from the Miami groups. They were going down to Cuba and bombing hotels, and you know, Cuba was investigating, and they were trying to find out ways to stop that, you know, and they were sending leaflets and doing flyovers with the Brothers to the Rescue, another group out of Miami. So a lot of terrorist things that were happening in Cuba, Cuba was trying to prevent them, so they had to send, they call them spies in the U.S. media. But they were actually, you know, had to go undercover to try to infiltrate the groups here that are run out of the United States. And there were five comrades that were basically rounded up and arrested after Cuba had presented the United States with the information. Instead of them arresting the terrorist groups that were run out of Florida, they arrested the five comrades, and they had been in jail since 98. Two of them have been released, but three are still in maximum security prisons. And been a big solidarity, international solidarity, for the Cuban Five. And even though it's been going on for, you know, 15 years, a lot of people don't know about it. So I've been trying to, you know, document things that are going on here. We just had a Cuba, they just had a 5 days for the Cuban Five last month in June here in D.C. That was the third one. They had various speakers and solidarity groups, and, you know, people from all over the world were here to, you know, join in solidarity to find out how we can create awareness, you know, and help to get the others released.
Okay. Hey, Sandy, you mentioned that you have been home based upon, you know, your mother was Cuban. You have been to Cuba several times. And I know you have done some film in Cuba. Matter of fact, I was honored and privileged to see one of the trailers you're working on, particularly as it represents Cuba from a cultural perspective. If Africans who have never been to Cuba go to Cuba for the first time, culturally speaking first, what kind of impact you think it may have on them? What would they see? What can they expect?
No, oh, that's big. Well, if they go to Cuba, okay, Africans would expect to feel, you know, I mean, the culture is all over the place. There's music going, you know, food. A lot of it is definitely, you know, African-based and derived from Africa. A lot of the food was brought there from, you know, slaves, so they still have a lot of the same dishes maybe that might, you know, African people, African American people will be used to. And the music, the culture, the people are, you know, very inviting. And a lot of the music, especially the African bass, because of the drum, like the conga drum and the bongos. And so I think people would enjoy it. I mean, I don't think people really, and I know a lot of people would love to go there. And I'm always hearing people asking me, you know, how is it, you know, and how can I get down there? And I tell them about my trips, and, you know, I just, hopefully we can, you know, erase this embargo and get rid of it. People can travel freely back and forth. That's what my wish would be.
I mean, basically, you said the word, how would you retreat? How would you receive? Because a lot of people have a misconception. You go to Cuba, you know, they're communist folks, they're evil, they're bad, they don't like you. How would you receive?
I don't know.
What was your reception?
People are very inviting. Yeah, people are very inviting, you know, very friendly. You know, they love, you know, American culture also. You know, they were very tied together for many, many centuries before, you know, the embargo, you know, in the 60s. So, you know, Cuban people are very, you know, understanding and friendly and open. They might not agree with the government, but they don't, you know, equate the government with, you know, people from the U.S. or other places, of course. So they don't have the same issues with other people from other countries that they do from the United States. But Cuban people are very open and friendly and outgoing people, and probably some of the friendliest people you'll meet, really, to be honest with you. And really, you feel like there's no crime when you're down there. I never had a problem. You know, it's not like some other, you know, even here in this country, you know, you feel more free, you know, it's not a crime, you know, you can walk around, don't feel like somebody's going to rob you or anything like that, or, you know, the conspiracy, all the conspiracy theories you might hear, it's very, definitely not true.
Okay, in terms of Cuba as a nation, we know can't no one man govern and run a whole country by himself. We also know that one man cannot think for millions and millions of people. Based upon your interaction with Cuba, politically speaking, how well-rounded have you found the Cuban people have been able to develop to the point where they can articulate and speak on policies and issues concerning their interests in the world? Politically speaking, how well-educated and politically educated have you found the Cuban people to be and their structures? That functions just like the CDR, you have the artist union, you have the women union. I mean, I have found Cuba, having a chance to go to Cuba many times myself. one of the things come to mind with Cuba to me is how very well organized and structured they are. And this whole question about democracy, I found it to be flourishing very well in Cuba in terms of how they collectively make decisions and make things done in terms of the full participation of the people from the down and from the top. So what has been your experience in terms of the overall development, educationally and politically, of the Cuban people when you interact with them?
Yeah, to me, I believe Cuban people are very well educated. You know, they have free education to PhD level, a doctorate degree, and you know, most of the Cuban people take well advantage of it, and they are very organized, as you said. They have a union, artist union, writers. You know, they have Ministry of Culture, which is very important, you know. So they have incorporated, you know, the arts and culture into their government, you know, where it's not just an independent thing. So everything is run basically through the government, but it's not just, you know, the Castro's running everything, or, you know, it's not just a top-down type of thing, that is very inclusive. And the people are able to vote. You know, I don't think people really realize that they have voted, you know, in every election, and very inclusive and encouraged for people to participate in the electorate. And there's a lot of rallies, and people are, you know, and in the television also, you know, where they can be educated on the issues.
Yeah, I found that to be interesting in terms of how they use their media, particularly the TV. I know they have a real popular program, I believe, come on Thursday evenings, called The Roundtable. But just the TV
right.
in general, how they have used the TV to educate the masses to have a better understanding of the world. For example, you know, one of the things I know they do is they take languages and they teach the language on the television where everybody around the country at the same time can be learning that particular language or learning that particular issue all at the same time. The way they use the television is very interesting in terms of how it has been a positive tool to be used to educate the people, as well as it seems like it's the opposite here in the United States. Television is probably one of the greatest weapons to create confusion and dumb down the consciousness of the people. Is that analogy a correct or incorrect one based upon your observation, Sandy?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's interesting that you said that. That is true. You know, I was thinking about certain things about that today. You know, I studied media, of course, undergrad and graduate school. But just to, you know, just think about the TV, how what you see on TV here compared to TV in Cuba. TV here, it can be used for good. I mean, you have the PBS channels, you have the other channels that, you know, is dedicated to educating the masses. But then you have, you know, unfortunately you had a freedom, people had a freedom to put garbage on TV and sell you things that you don't need every couple of, you know, every five, ten minutes on TV. Whereas they have no, like, advertising. They don't have advertising on TV. They don't have advertising on radio or billboards or anything like that, selling you things that you don't need. It's not driven by advertisement, whereas, you know, TV, definitely media here is driven by advertisement. So it's really not in the best interest. It probably will be in the best interest of the company that's trying to sell you whatever. And it is a dumbing down of TV here for sure. You know, probably in the past 20 years or 25 years, you know, you could see certain shows just, I mean, it's really pathetic, to be honest with you. But TV, down there, they do have educational TV, you know, and you can learn languages. They have films. They have education and entertainment also. But there is nothing, you know, like the dumbing down of a population or trash TV or trash reality TV, as people call it. I don't think they're missing anything in it, not having it.
Exactly. I concur with you. Sister, in terms of just your general understanding of what you may know, in terms of the differences of the realities of the Cuba before 1955 and in Cuba after 1955, particularly in terms of the Cuban Revolution impact on the Africans in Cuba. What is it about Cuba today after 1959? Why it has increased and gained the support of the African people inside of Cuba? Some people call them Afro-Cubans, but when we're talking about African people in Cuba, they seem to gravitate around this Cuban Revolution, this social process that has taken place since 1959, while at the same time, in the West, particularly the U.S., they try and create a division between the Cubans, period, around the question of race and racism. Can you just talk a little bit about the general phenomena?
I've noticed just being, you know, my visits in Cuba, they do, I mean, Afro-Cuba is very, you know, popular. Everybody is, I mean, I don't care if you're white, black, Chinese, or whatever, you know, everybody is in the culture, you know, is celebrated. African culture is celebrated in Cuba. And I think after the revolution is because they were able to get, you know, more access and resources to the African people or people from African descent. Were able to have free education and health care, and they had better living conditions. And whereas before then, you know, it was pretty much like here, you know, Jim Crow. The U.S. had taken Jim Crow there, of course, like they do all over the world. African people had more of a stake, you know, felt more of a stake, and their culture was more respected. So I think pretty much everybody, you know, to me, what I viewed and observe there, African culture, Afro-Cuban culture is very, very important. It's very, you know, pretty much intertwined with just Cuban culture, you know, it's one and same. And I think that's very important.
Good. How's the, one of the things we talk about Cuba, we talk about the beaches, we talk about the beautiful jazz festivals they have. But, you know, for me, I think the best part of Cuba, Sister Sandy, is, really just people, just the loving, caring, the interaction of how they interact with each other and with human beings. That's how I see Cuba. I think when you talk about the best part, the human development of human beings inside of Cuba, acting like human beings, this is the most beautiful part. Now, when you talk about Cuba and think about Cuba, what would be two of the major things that stand out for you?
Oh, God, the major thing that stand out for me about Cuba, I guess, family, that's the first thing that comes to my mind because of my family. You know, I went there last year in November, went to celebrate my aunt's birthday. She turned 100 years old, and there was about nine of us from my family that were here, my two aunts. You know, we went down there and some cousins who had never been there. And so we really had a great time. So that would be the first thing that come to my mind is family, the love of the people. You know, it comes straight from my family, but the love of people, period, in general, I think anybody would find that. If they went to Cuba, they would feel that, feel the love of the people.
And earlier, one thing you did say is the Cuban people are educated and conscious of making a difference between the U.S. government and the U.S. people. Basically, again, what has been their attitude toward the U.S. people? Do you see them being hostile at the U.S. people? Or do you see them as, you know, embracing and loving them too? Can you just speak to your audience?
It's definitely embracing. They love American culture, they pretty much, you know, like Cuba and the U.S. were very close for many centuries. Until this recent history, you know, after the Cuban Revolution and, you know, then the Cuban embargo, so it pretty much is the isolation. So this generation, you know, after that, maybe not know that Cuban people are very interested and very open to American culture and American people. There is a connection, and a very big connection there. And, like, you know, Cuban people know more about maybe American people. Maybe American people know about Cuba. Maybe that's what the problem is. They don't. put any like negative, you know, baggage on American tourists coming in.
From my experience,
they will be welcome.
Okay, Sandy, from my experience going to Cuba in terms of your last point, I think you are being very, very generous to the American people in terms of their know-how of what they know about each other. I would argue with anybody, the Cuban people probably know 10 times more about American people, their lifestyle, than what American people know about anything about Cuba and the Cuban people. I have found it to be very...
Yeah, I can agree with you on that.
...conscious when it comes to the world. I mean, you can take up any brother and sister and go just about anywhere, whether they're working or not. They are educated and conscious of the world. Their so-called unemployment, which is directly related to the embargo, is totally different from the unemployment that you find in other countries. They have an educated unemployment sector, if you want to call that. And they have no problem in sharing their skills and talent with the world, and not based upon money. I mean, you know, I think this great gift that they're giving the world now in terms of the School of Medicine, Elam.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they are training doctors from all over the world. And matter of fact, what most people don't know, the next set of African doctors in this country that are going to be trained to be doctors most likely can come from this school, and that inside America. So in terms of that regard, I just think that, you know, anytime people have had a chance to go to Cuba, they need to come back and don't glamorize it, but just tell the truth. Tell what you have seen and what it is. I think the Cuba is clear in terms of they can defend themselves. But these issues that come down to Cuba about all this craziness, you know, it's just that. It's not based upon the truth. So, Sandy, we only have a few minutes. I want you to stay online because later on we can come back. Where people can ask questions with my guests so far. One, we had a discussion on what's going on in Richmond around the ball field and the issue of ancestry cemetery to maintain it. We talked a little bit, and we just highlighted Cuba, giving a perspective from a young lady whose mother was Cuban, and she does a lot of documentaries and films and pictures on Cuba in terms of looking at Cuba from her perspective. What we're going to do is we're going to take another pause for the calls for about 1 minute. When we come back, we're going to open up our phone line. We're supposed to have another discussion, but right now I don't see my guest on. So what we're going to do is for all our listeners, please call in at 323-679-0841. 323-679-0841. Make sure you punch 1 if you want to speak. You have any questions, comments. So Sandy, Namia, y'all stay on the line. We're going to open it up to our callers when we come back, but we're going to take another pause for the calls. That's right. You're listening to Brother Africa at Africa on the Move. We'll be back in about 1 minute. African people, all of humanity. That's right. I'm in the seat. I take the heat. I define it, and I stand behind it. I'm Brother Africa, or Africa on the Move. We come on every Sunday evening from 7 to 9. Tell your friends, your neighbors that you listen to the best show in town. We're going to speak truth through power. We don't know anything other than that. So let's move forward right now. We have our host, our guest tonight, Sister Sandy Waters and Sister Namia. They were sharing some issues concerning some perspectives of where they are, the nature of the work that they're doing. We open up our lines. We have any questions that you may have for them. Or if you just want to share some things that are going on in your community. And remember, if you want to speak, please hit 1 on your phone line, and we will recognize you by calling your last 3 numbers. We can call your last 3 numbers, and you can, whatever comments or information you'd like to share with our audience, we'd be happy to hear that. Again, please call 323-679-0841. Our first caller, they have the last four numbers, 9303. Call them 9303. Welcome to Africa on your Move. Your question, comment, please.
Yes, sir. Once again, happy belated birthday, brother. And I'm sorry I missed it, but you're doing a very informative thing on the show. You're informing the people about the African past and everything. This is Brother Shaka.
Thank you, Brother Shaka.
And I'd like to say, I'm doing great, brother. I'd like to say I'm talking about what I just went through, finally coming home and everything. I think they should have more program for people that prep and prepare themselves to get out when they come from prison. If you don't prep and prepare yourself to come home from prison, and then once you get out of prison, the Afro-American especially, they have 2 strikes against them. One, that they have a hue, and the second, that they're a felon. And these 2 things stick out like a sore thumb and stagnate their life and stifle their life from in and out of spirits in society, like work, jobs, or anything else. You know, I've been looking for a job now for like 18 months, and I haven't been successful at finding no job. And it was difficult for me to find an apartment to live in, because a lot of apartments I tried to get in, they were saying they don't take felons, they don't take people with drug charges, they don't take people with gun charges, you know. So these things are stigmas in my life that I'm stifling me and held me back in a certain place in society.
Okay, Brother Chaka, you're a really interesting person. I had a chance to meet you maybe about a little more than 2 weeks ago or less.
Yes,
and
sir.
And we were talking about your history. Just a little bit in
yes,
terms
sir.
Of how they send our kids to these pipelines. Give people just a brief little history of how you end up in that institution and what you did when you came out in terms of how positive role model you have been in terms of trying to give back to those who end up
yes,
in those situations
let
like
me,
you.
Let me say this first. I read about Tukey Williams and how he made an astronomical change while he was on death row and got one of the first prison receiver a Nobel Peace Prize on death row and changed his life 360 degrees. And they still executed the brother, so that can't be no form of rehabilitation. So when I came home, when I was in prison, I couldn't read and write that well when I first got there. They railroaded me. So if I didn't plead guilty, I'm going to get 80 years, but I wound up pleading guilty to 20. And I got to 20 years, and I went to prison in 1977. I got out around 1991. And I was like 17, 18 when I went in. And, never had a charge a day in my life. Didn't have money for an attorney. And they tried to accuse me of 4 or 5 murders and about 3 or 4 robberies. And several other things they tried to accuse me of, ladies accused me of. But anyway, make a long story short, brother, when I got there, I met a sister named Audrey Williams at Southampton Farm in 1978. She was a school teacher, but had been from Charlottesville. She took a personal interest in me and tried to help me get my GED, and we corresponded for the next 5 or 10 years while I was locked up. And I got my GED in 1982 in Spring Street. Then, having the desire that I had, I said, well, our people was denied education years ago and went for third grade months. We still probably wouldn't be able to ride a bus or go to school. So I decided to come back and be a tutor. So I started tutoring when I was in Mecklenburg, when Mecklenburg with the Bradley Boy was there, when I was at Greenville Institution, plus when I was at DeWall, I became a tutor. I came home, and I tried to do some more tutoring. I stayed out like 18 years and caught a new charge. But this charge, I didn't do this charge, but I was charged to accuse me of 77 and 76. That was a laser accuse, but I didn't do them charges. They just railroaded me with them. And the charge I got in 2001 was a drug charge. But anyway, when I got to prison this time, I still became a tutor. And this time I also tutored Afro-American history classes. and taught about Malcolm King and a lot of other people that inspired people and paved the way for people, you know. And I try to pave the way for those who didn't have a GED to get a GED. I try to help tell them how important the GED was. Like, if you enhance your mind, you enhance your future. You know, you had to prep and prepare yourself to be prepared to come back into society once you get there, because people were still changing and moving in society, and we were stagnated in prison. We don't have the opportunity to be involved in a lot of things in prison, but if you prep and prepare yourself, then you can't go wrong once you get out here, because you'll be right on the one. You know, I believe in the 5 P's. Proper preparation prevents poor performance.
Okay, Brother Shaka, we're going to put you on hold. We thank you. You can always come back. We'll go on to our next caller. We're calling caller number 3330. Caller 3330. Welcome to Africa and Move. Question, comments, what you'd like to share with our people today?
Yeah, I'd like to make a comment in regards to the ballpark situation in Richmond, Virginia.
Okay.
Being a native of Richmond, this is Brother Jabari Bike. It's a privilege once again to be on the program. And in regards to the situation in Richmond, Virginia, you know, I don't find it unusual that they would want to desecrate where the ancestors' remains lay, considering a number of developments that have happened recently, because also a very popular leader in Richmond, Brother Celine Califani, chairman of the Richmond NAACP, was ousted. It was an inside job, and he was ousted from his position as, I believe it was field organizer. Am I correct for the Africa?
Yes.
So it was Brother Celine's position, field organizer.
He was very good at
speaking on a number of issues, like the ballpark and other issues, and it's just showing that even though Richmond's a mostly black city, it's run with a European mentality. It's not reflecting the interests of the majority of the people that live there, but it's reflecting the greater corporate interest.
Okay. Sister Namia, any response to this young man's response about the makeup and attitude of the city and their mentality?
Well, he's right on point, because the city is really run by a corporate. And even though there's a lot of African people that live here, they're not concerned about how we feel about anything. Basically, it's all about money. Economics drives the city, that is for sure.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you, Carla. We'll leave you on hold. We'll come back later on if you still have something to say as we go along. We'll take our next caller, caller 4381, caller 4381. You're on Africa on the Move.
Hi there. This is Sister Hattie. And,
Sister Hattie, how you doing, Sister Hattie?
I am great. I wanted to just comment with both your guests that, first of all, is it Sister Nami in Richmond?
Yes.
One of the things, it's great that you've taken this on, so you're kind of like the person that is the point person for having a heart to save our history and that peace. And one of the things that I'm finding is that's what it takes for us to progress, either in historic kinds of responsibilities as well as social justice movement and any injustices that are going wrong. When we as a people, we decide that this is important, and I think it's nothing less than God speaking and saying, you take this one on, you take this responsibility, that's your gifting, you walk with this. And so that being said, if we don't continue to do that, and if you don't take what you have in you, the heart that you have to preserve this most historic burial place in this area, then you have to instill it in somebody else to keep taking it on and on and on and on. Otherwise, it will be gone, because we know how important history is. And like I said on the show a couple of times before, Brother Africa, let me tell you, I just really believe in my heart of hearts that's what part of the Iraqi situation was to desecrate the history of black people, the African people, because there in that area lies, it's just a cradle of historic pieces that are ancient. And if you can take that and desecrate it and get rid of all of the artifacts that they had in the museums there, you've really done a lot to make sure that people are not going to be able to keep up with their history. And the same with in Egypt. When they put the Aswan Dam in there, scientists and people all over the world said, if you put this dam here, this is going to cause drought all over Africa. Well, guess what? That's exactly what the people wanted to do that were in power. Otherwise, they would not have done that. They killed two birds with one stone on that one. You flooded the area where ancient Kemet was, where there were historical sites, so it's all underwater. Guess what? The history is gone. And so there's a concerted effort throughout the world, not just in Richmond, Virginia, but the world, to destroy the African people's history. And we have to be the cupbearers of this. Those of us who know this and have the knowledge and have the heart for it. And so I just want to thank you for caring in that and just keep speaking out about it and do some of all the things that we need to do. You know, we have to really raise the funding, get some foundations. And one of the critical pieces that I think we really have to look at is making sure these kinds of places get placed in the historical society. We have to put this in history, the mainstream history, not just us single-handedly fighting that these kinds of areas be kept up. So that's what I wanted to say there, is that it's a historical site. There needs to be some, we have to look at it legislatively, going to the lawmakers, having your local people put that in place as a historic site so that it can't be touched, even when you're gone or the next person is gone. But these are historic sites. That's how we have to handle this business if our history is going to be kept and safe. So that's that piece there.
Did you want to respond to the Cuba piece?
Yes.
I think you said you want to respond to both of them. What about the sister with the Cuba piece, Sister Sandy?
I just wanted to say with Sister Sandy, thank you so much, because I've learned something else about Cuba today with your just being on the show as well, that the connections there, and I knew about some of them, but we have to keep, and I have known about the apartheid support that Cuba sent, which is probably why, you know, anytime there's injustice anywhere in the world, and the people that stand up for it usually get penalized or punished, just like those of us in this country who walk with justice and will not tolerate injustice for anybody. We are the people that are going to be pushed down, tried to shut down. And so certainly Cuba has been in that role, and we have to keep bringing that forth. And it's a remembering, and it's a historical piece. And a lot of people don't know that part. And you made me remember it. Sometimes we know stuff, and until we hear it again, we don't know it, because it gets pushed back in our memory. And so how do we keep these things in the forefront of our minds is really good to know as well. So thank you, Sister Sandra.
All right. Sure.
Thank you, Sister.
I'd like to make a comment on what you said about historically preservation. A couple of weeks ago down in Chaco Bottom, there was a news conference where the ancestral grounds was put on the record through National Archives in Washington, D.C., as a result of the National Preservation Society here in Richmond, and it was being designated as one of the most endangered historical sites in Virginia. And that brought a lot of attention to what was really going on, because the major networks picked it up, the New York Times picked it up, and a lot of media across the country picked it up. So the eyes of the world is really on Chaco Bottom right now. And I also would like to bring attention to the fact that even before I got involved with this, that there was several organizations such as the African Ancestral Chamber, the Defenders for Freedom, Justice, and Equality, and Collective X, along with many other organizations that have been dealing with this issue for years about Shackle Bottom. This is not a new issue, and I am basically a Johnny-come-lately to the situation. I knew about it, but I just got involved with it since the beginning of the year. So I want to give credit to those other entities that have been pushing for years, first of all, to get that concrete off of the burial grounds, and then when that whole idea of getting a stadium being put on, which was not the first time that this has come up, but this has been coming up for the last couple of years by the mayor and other people. So I want to give credit to those other people who have really been pushing and fighting at the forefront for our ancestors to be remembered and honored.
You know, before I go to my next caller, I'd like to get y'all's sister response, and maybe even a brother too had called in. Sister Namia, I read in the article about that situation that we're talking about in Richmond that I believe he was the president of the chamber, Richmond Chamber of Commerce. He made a general statement about why would somebody want to come and visit a slave museum. I'd like to just get people's response to that. Here he's head of the Richmond Chamber of Commerce, and he made a statement, why would someone come and visit African Slave Museum? What would be your response to that, Sister Namia?
Well, because they want to know the true history of how Richmond got started economically. And economically, Richmond got started, as I said before, every major institution because of slavery. And this is a part of the history of Richmond. It shouldn't be hidden. It should be, you know, people should know. I mean, Charleston, South Carolina, which is almost like a sister city to Richmond, Virginia, everybody is rallying behind the slave museum that's built in Charleston. And they're embracing it because they understand that, you know, the true story of the city is important to everybody, not just Africans, but everybody. People need to be conscious of where they live at and the history behind where they live at. So I find it very ignorant that he would make a statement like that. I'm wondering when they were building the Jewish Holocaust Museum, which is not too far from the ancestral grounds, did he ask the Jewish community, why would you want to build, you know, a Jewish museum, you know, in remembrance of the Holocaust? Just the way they want to remember that horrible thing that went over in Europe, we have to remember what has happened to us here in America and throughout the Americas. It's very important for us to remember where we came from, how we got here, what we've been through, in order to strengthen us, in order for us to go forward. We have to be cognizant of where we came from. And our children need to know our history so that even though they might be in a certain situation, they can gain strength from the fact that our ancestors were in the bowels of a ship and came here and had a life of nothing but servitude, but they looked in the future and saw us having a better opportunity to move forward in our lives, and from that itself will make them strong to go through whatever challenges they're going through right now. And our youth need to have that strength to go through what they're going through now and make sure that their children have a better tomorrow. This is an important story, and it cannot be glossed over, you know, paved over, put a stadium on top of it, and just act like it never happened. This is our story, and we have to preserve this history. And Mr. Schiller, he just needs to sit down somewhere because he's just like a dinosaur, you know, because even a lot of Europeans in this city are realizing how important this story is so that we can move forward and that we can do some things together. We have to acknowledge what happened in this city. We have to stop being in denial about the horrors of slavery and its after effects.
Can I share something with you on that one, Brother Africa?
Can I ask you to hold for 1 second? Let me get a response from Sister Sandy, then we come to you, Sister Hattie.
Okay.
Sister Sandy?
Yes.
What would be your response if based upon what the Europeans say, why would there be a need? Why would people want to come and visit a slave museum? And he's from the Richard Chamber Thomas here. What's your response to that? What would you say to him?
Well, I love history. Personally, I believe that history, you know, museums are very important to document the history that has happened. You know, regardless whether it's a painful history, you just have to, still you have to have your museums there. You have to sit, like, the other caller said, if you don't study your history, you're bound to repeat itself. And I think a lot of people are very lost, when it comes to history. They're not very educated in history in this country especially. It's probably because of the propaganda machine. So you definitely need your museums so they can be preserved and the truth can be told.
Okay. Sister Hattie, your response?
Okay. Yeah, what I wanted to share is that I think across the color line, there's just so much shame involved with that slavery institution, number one. And number two, there's so much of institutional racism, as we speak here, 2014, that's involved. And it's a very complex situation because it seems to me, I'm in public education. I was in it for 40 years. And I would see children throughout the years, let's say the 80s, 90s, and 2000s, that would be so ashamed of slavery that you could just see them recoil, and they didn't want to hear about that historical piece. And yet, it was a history. And so the gentleman that said that experiences either shame or the racism of we're going to try to hide this, or conspiracy more or less, so that we can do this again and do whatever we want to again to these people. If we take their history away from them, you're bound to repeat it. And so some people have put together a great format to have it all repeated again and again and again. And we're almost to that stage now because that's all the penal system is. The brother that came on earlier, it's just a colony. It's a form of slavery because across the world now we know that America is the only place that incarcerates its people at such an alarming rate and for very minor infractions. The things across in some of the European countries around drugs, they are actually legal, where it is illegal here. And we know that when we take a look at the crack cocaine and the natural powder cocaine issue that came about, that one of the judges from Minnesota actually put that forth, Pam Alexander, Judge Pam Alexander. You know, you looked at the incarceration rates for people selling crack, doing crack. It was very different from what European Americans were doing. The white guys could use powder cocaine, and it was very minimal what their sentencings were. And so we know that this penal system is set up. It's nothing more than modern-day slavery, and the same with the foster care system that's in place to take our children out of our community, put them in other people's community, to break that historical piece, to break the family down. So I think that if, in fact, it's the chain or either with the Chamber of Commerce man, and it could be a black or white person anymore, it's that complicated. You have to just look at what people's mindsets are. And we have a gentleman in Minnesota who has insisted upon selling our children down the tube to the pharmaceutical companies, to psychotropic drugs, where we have what's called African-American Forum that will actually, there's a Dr. Cicchetti who came out of New York and now he's in Minneapolis, Minnesota. He's been there for 5 or 6 years and they have keep running the same play to bring these little African American children in, do research on them, and they're usually in the foster care system or either they're very poor. And he believes, Dr. Cicchetti believes, he's a white guy,
psychiatrist, he believes you can identify mental illness as early as 6 months old and give children psychotropic drugs. Anyway, I could go on and on. I won't belabor the issue. But you get my point on what I'm saying. You got that man must be ashamed or some way. And why would he try to keep selling the children down the tube? A group of us stopped him before and putting in a mental health research center right in the heart of the African-American community. We protested. So they just, 5-6 years later, take it around the corner, build it up on another place, and run the play again. And this is an African-American man who's leading this and who wants this. And so we have people that are wanting to sell our children out, and we have to be aware of our people and other people who are not, and they don't have the mindset. And then we know that there are some very great people on both sides, too, that understand this, and they want to do what is right. And they have very social just attitudes that are black and white. So, anyway, shame and institutional racism.
Okay, we'd like to let our listening audience know that you can call in at 323-679-0841. You are listening to the voice of Brother Africa or Africa on the Move. We have a caller who has been real patient so far, Brother Moses. We're going to be coming to you right after we just get a response from Brother Jabari to the last statement we're speaking to. Brother Jabari, you'd like to make a statement, a comment on that statement by the young man from the Greater Richmond Chambers of Richmond. How would you respond to
that? Given he has a position with the Greater Richmond Chambers and Commerce, I don't find it surprising he made such an ill-informed comment, because it's clear that he represents capitalism and he's all about promoting that which would have a profit. And the thing about it, the reason why I'm an advocate for it, it wouldn't be much of a thing about profit, more so as to letting people know the background of how Richmond got it started, how Richmond got it started up, and what how Richmond got it started, then also looking at why Richmond is the way it is today. So, like I said, it doesn't surprise me, it disappoints me, but it's more reason for something of that nature to be built so that we can possibly change the mindset of some of these simpletons, and then, well, for the others, they just need to let them know that people are aware of the true reality for what it is.
All right, we thank you, Brother Jabari, and we now will bring on long-awaited, and we thank you for your patience, Brother Moses. Any views or comments that you'd like to share with our people based upon our show tonight, Brother Moses?
Thank you, thank you, thank you. I just want to say it's a wonderful guest you have. Everybody's on point, and it's just great to be around an intellectual crowd that knows what time it is. And I just want to plug a little book. Jerome Horn, I can't even remember his name. The Counter-Revolution of 1776. The Counter-Revolutionary of 1776. It's about, you know, how basically the Anglo colonists took one step forward, and the African American and Native American people took two steps backward in terms of what was going on in the United States of America. It was the first apartheid state, and I just think, you know, that's a good book, and I don't have enough time to go through it, but that's what the book is about, and I'm actually reading it now myself. I'm just on the first chapter.
Okay, Brother Moses, we thank you as always. We're expecting for our next guest to come on in the next few minutes. If she doesn't come on, we shall be going doing a segment on New York City. If she doesn't arrive in the next few minutes, we'll continue our discussion. We'd like to let our listening audience know that you are listening to Africa on the Move every Sunday from 7 to 9 p.m. This is the place where you can hear truth spoken to power on Africa on the Move. We'll take a little station break. We'll come back and continue this. You are listening to Africa on the Move with your host, Brother African. We'll be right back. Let's pause for the calls.
Center of the world. Latitude zero, longitude zero. Planned by the Creator. Sisanthropus, was the first man found on the earth. That earth was the motherland, Africa. We know that without total understanding of what happened in the past, it would be difficult to relate to the future. We know that within the structure of the music, there should be a message, and the message should be truth. So now, we give you Africa, the center of the world.
Africa is the center of the world. We are African people, period. Whether you're born in West Africa, North America, Europe, South America, the Caribbean, we are African people with one aim, one goal, one destiny. And of course, as a Pan-African, the only goal we must have is the goal of Pan-Africanism, which is probably defined as the total liberation and unification of Africa under scientific socialism. So we on tonight with Sister Sandy and Namia. They're giving their views and perspectives on what's going on in the city of Richmond, Virginia, and what is going on in Cuba. Cuba just had their independence celebration day yesterday, July 26th. And we're talking about its relevance and its reality, as well as this attitude about disrespecting African history and culture, where they won't put a baseball field, all things, baseball stadium, or the African burial ground. What else do they want to do to us? They did everything they could, and it looks like they don't want to stop. How can we stop? How can we stop the mistreatment of African people and humanity? What can we do about that? Call in and let me know. Give me your views and perspective. Call Brother Africa. And it looks like we may have that sister Queen Mother Dolores Barkley. Are you there, sister? Can you hear me?
Yes, I am.
Oh, excellent. You're right on time, right on time. You're on Africa on the Move, and we're giving our perspectives on different issues as relates to our community. We thought it would be interesting to give a sister from your area, from out of New York, an opportunity to speak to the world in terms of what's going on in the African community up there. What are some of the major issues and contradictions, and how do we move our people forward? People want to know. In America, through my travels, they constantly ask me, what are the African people going to do in America? Because historically, when African people move, the world moves to follow them inside America. We are the most revolutionary force inside America. But the problem is right now, our people are unconscious of our history and our contribution to humanity. So, Sister Queen Mother Dolores, talk to us. What's going on in the city, the Big Apple? What are some of the issues and contradictions that African people and people in general is fighting?
In New York City, I'm the community mayor of Harlem, and I'm the ambassador of goodwill to Africa. And I am involved in the spirit of Queen Mother Audley Moore, who lived to be almost 100 years old, and today is her Earth Day. And Queen Mother had one single issue, and the word was reparations. And this is what we are fostering around the world And especially at the UN, they are moving toward memorializing our ancestor and will be erecting a monument in the spirit of the middle passage of the transatlantic slave trade, the victim of slavery, and that is our ancestors. So that is an accomplishment, again, in the spirit of Queen Mother Moore, and where she really was a woman of a movement. Queen Mother Moore was involved with many issues amongst our people, and I guess we say today, where are we? In New York City, I'm sure that you're aware that the police did the chokehold on our brother here in New York City, which we are suffering from, and we have been in mourning and prayer for toward his family. The other issue, as you know, that we have systemic dealing with our young people, are killing their own seed. And when I say that, Queen Mother Moore would remind us that we are suffering from psychoneurosis. We cannot blame the victim, but how do we become made whole again? And in that, she's made it very clear to us with the fourth grade education. We must go back through the transatlantic ocean of the slave trade and return back to the soil of Mother Africa. And in that quest, Queen Mother said, we begin the healing, the transformation, the reconnecting to our bloodline, which is our DNA, and begin to possess all of the resources that we have inherited from the land itself. You look at the diamonds, the gold, the oil, and the many other natural resources which the children that are the descendants of Mother Africa have a right to. And as she called and wanted us to be conscious of, and I was with Queen Mother for about 20 years, she talked about reparation. She says the greatest crime ever committed against the people has been the transatlantic slave trade, and the world owes us. It seems that everyone else is getting paid of their resources based on the crime. And in the spirit of Queen Mother, sister, I'm sure you probably heard of her. Her name is Deidre Farmer Pelma, which she's been doing the lawsuits of claiming those who came through their descendants and their ancestors of insurance company, all of those who had any hand in the demise of this great crime, which one of our descendants called it a helicast, not a holocaust, but a helicast is what we have endured as African people. And I will add to it, we are the displaced Africans. And I will not forget, and I'm sure that you might have remembered that it would be the first year that Mandiva, which is our elder Nelson Mandela, July the 18th, was his first Earth Day that he was not amongst us this year. And we planted trees in New York and reminding, as Queen Mother said to Nelson Mandela in 1990 when she had to be declared along with me as honorary white in order to go to South Africa at that time to embrace our elder Nelson Mandela coming out of prison. And she said to him, never forget the children who died in the liberation struggle in Soweto. And we today must never forget how the blood runs strong and in the soil, which we planted a tree in Marcus Garvey's Park for our children here in Harlem, that the blood runs deep in the soil even here. When we think that the disrespect that we have for each other because we don't know who we are, where you have the young bloods, the young people, in other words, are killing not only their family members, but killing their own seed. So we are in a state of affair about the gun war within our community. How do we bring about the peace that we need, not only in Harlem and in Brooklyn and in New York and the Bronx and Staten Island and the different boroughs, but I'm sure it's all over the United States, whether that's Chicago, Philadelphia, wherever it may be, deep down south or up north, that is a problem that we must all reckon with. And then when we see the disconnect of our children that makes up the prison life, their lives are snatched, where we're dealing with not only the youngsters that came from Africa, Amadou Diallo shot 41 times some years ago, but the shooting and the snatching of our young people with the frisk brutality and the frisking them in their own community and beyond. And we're saying, how do we get a hold on that energy that has accelerated within the last 10 to 15 years? And what do we do in really reclaiming our children through the mother's energy? And we as mothers are calling on reclaiming our youth, reclaiming our young people. How can we look at the issues that they are confronted with through the hip-hop energy, the hip-hop world? As I serve as one of the ambassadors of goodwill to Senegal, and I began to take the young hip-hop generation in 2010 to begin that energy of returning to the soil of Mother Africa, as we look at issues that young people are crying out, which is education. When we look at that, many of our children have never been given a decent education in their lives, which they are entitled to, which is a human rights issue. When you look at the staggering conditions of the health modality for our family, whether that's HIV, AIDS, or just the quality of health, and the President Barack Obama is trying to usher in health care. What is the health care and the plan for the next generation and for our family today? And where we look at the whole disparity of the health treatment and care within our own community. We look at the word unemployment. Young people are idle, standing up. How do we nurture our children when they have wavered and strayed from just the basic nurturing from our family? We are nurturing people, and how have our children just strayed to strangers for advice and guidance? And where are we? And with our children that don't have a handle on family, unemployment that forces them to walk the streets, and in all conditions of walking the streets, whether that's dealing with drug trafficking, whether that's dealing with prostitution for our girl child in the streets, whether that's dealing with the homelessness, whether that's dealing with there is no sense of belonging, where the nurturing, where babies is having babies. Where are we as a family? Where are we as mothers, as women, as nurturers to our children? When you look at the homelessness, that you look at, there is not enough shelter, which we're saying the basics. What do we eat? What are we taking? What kind of drugs are being given to our families in terms of putting them into the box of life? What are we doing? How do we come out of it? How do we cry to the God force and call on our ancestors to be with us at this most trying times in our lives? We can look beyond us and look at the bigger picture, but we have to focus on our picture today and go within and get our children and grab them and pull them to us and not be afraid of them. You have family members, mothers and fathers, brothers and sisters, cousins, uncles and aunts are afraid of the children. We are afraid of our own seed.
What must we do about this as we go before the prayers? We go to church, we go to mosques, we go to synagogues, we go to different persuasions of religion. Are we calling on the God of life to protect and preserve our generations yet not even born? So this is the message of the cry as a mother, which I'm an elder. And if we disrespect the mother at all form of violence against her, then what are we saying when you look at Mother Earth, how we have desecrated even her? What are we doing? And we want to know about why the life, why is the universe is off balance, are angry with us, is angry with us. The creative energy of God, life, of our innate gift to nurture, where are we? And I call on the mother's energy, the mothers from the transatlantic ocean of the slave trade, together, the greatest crime ever committed against us, to be strong and to focus, to be one for those that we must continue to nurture and guide and mentor through life, and call on God, the force, whatever name we may call that force and that life greater than all of us, call on that force to heal our family, our divine family, our sacred life, our sacred seed of nurturing. We call on that life force. And that is the reflection that I have for the family tonight in the spirit of Queen Mother Audley Moore, who lived to be almost 100 years old. She was a movement in herself, and she left us a legacy, which is a movement. Of movement to the divine family of life. And that is what I bring forward tonight with the family. And I thank you for allowing me to raise my voice as Queen Mother Dr. Deloise Blakely, the Community Mayor of Harlem, the Ambassador of Goodwill. And you can go out and begin to read about who I am, the Harlem Street Nun, and other works that I would be coming forward, and the work on Queen Mother Moore. I'm finishing her book. It'll be out very shortly. But go out and gather some of the work that I've been doing for the last 50 years as an elder. But in the legacy energy, one of the great heroines that lived during my lifetime, and that is Queen Mother Audley Moore. And as we call on our other great warrior mothers, and that Sojourner Truth, Harriet Tubman, we could look at the great kings and queens, and especially those queen mothers, Queen Hatshepsut, which that is the ancestor energy from whence I come, from the Nile of Egypt. And then other great queens and queen mothers, whether that's the Shanti Kingdom and the great king of the Kentut family, and you look at other great Mandinga people, you also look at the current royal family of spirituality. You're talking about Touba in Senegal, a place called Touba, the holy spiritual of Sheikh Amadou Bamba, the elder, the spirit one, the holy one, who said that we will return to the shores of the sea. And every trick in the book was thrown after him, but they never was able to annihilate him or to kill him. And that is Sheikh Amadou Bamba, who said that one day millions will come, as he asked to pray during his voyage on the trip with the French. And he asked them, could he pray? And they told him he could not pray on that ship in the Middle Passage. And in saying that to him, they looked down at the sea, and there he was on his prayer rug and saying, Allahu Akbar, God is the greatest in all things. And he also made it clear that we, the children, will come back through the Middle Passage of the transatlantic ocean and be made whole again. And so that is the prayer that I hold for Goree Island, since I'm the Queen Mother of Goree. For the last 20-some-odd years, I've been bringing our young people back to be made whole through the Middle Passage and through the slave trade. And there is a warrior brother who is on the sea while I'm speaking with you, and his name is Mooney, Victor Mooney, and he's rowing for HIV/AIDS from Goree Island, Senegal, to the Brooklyn Bridge in New York City. And because he lost his siblings, his brothers, from HIV/AIDS, and that's what he's rowing for, and he is halfway the journey, and he has lost 80 pounds, and we are just tracking him on the sea right now, a black young man from Bedford-Stuyvesant in New York City, in Brooklyn in particular. So there again, great things are happening because the young people are making it happen on every front, but we must all pull together and row together and come together and stand together and be able to just put up one fist, which we say to all of us, we ask the God force within us to give us peace. Peace be still. Peace to the divine family.
Okay, sister, in terms of the assessment that you have just given, many people within the African community will argue or take a position that the biggest issues that are facing our people, no matter where we are, is a political issue. It's a political issue in terms of we have not collectively came together to decide what is fundamentally the issues that are confronting our people in terms of the being oppressed. Not until we resolve the political question, that it'd be very difficult for any kind of economic collective activity to take place. What is your view on that position?
Politically, there have been brothers and sisters taking a position, and even Queen Mother took a position, going to Washington and lobbying for Marcus Masai Garvey and to exonerate him. That was heavy politically. And she took the position on reparations from the United Nations to Washington, D.C., to Congressman John Conyers, and he's still in the Congress, and you have the call in COBRA, National Black Reparation. Today, politically, even at the United Nations, the member states are discussing the African descendants because of CARICOM countries, which is the Caribbean, on the issue and the state of African descendants. And as you know, today they're also taking up the issue of Africans living in the diaspora. Also, the brothers and sisters went politically to South Africa for the racism conference that took place a few years ago. And so that there are the agitation and the building of us on many levels, that we're doing it in many circles. But I think today we have to all now begin to come together and talk about the commonality to address our issues. But the issues are on the table as I travel the world. I'm just returning from a place called Trinidad and Tobago, and there again issues are being taken up. And then from Jamaica, spending time with Mama Rita Molly, and now pray for her because of a health disparity at the moment, of talking to her and watching the next generation of Bob Marley boys, his children, his girls, and talking to them, where are they today in the liberation struggle of a people? And you're looking at the Zulu Nation. They are highly political. I am the Queen Mother of hip-hop. And through their voice and through their music and through their education and the training of the next generation, which they're doing, they're having classes, how to eat to live, which you must be able to know how to eat, to live, how to defend yourself. And what do you do about this defending self? What is martial art to us? And the world travels, whether that's going to China, whether that is going to the Asia areas to see what is barred or what their relation is to Africa. That's highly political. If you're going to China, you can't get no political than that. As a black man or black woman in quest to where the billions of people are going on the planet Earth, and especially toward Africa, and what is our position on the homeland, and what is our position on Mississippi, what is our position on Texas, what is our position on New Orleans, what is our position in the Delta, what is our position on Selma, what is our position in Newark, New Jersey, what is our position? And we have to take a political stance. And there are groups that is agitating, and there are groups who are taking those positions from where they stand and where they're at today.
So it does exist.
Thank
you for your assessment of what's going on in New York. Unfortunately, we're running out of time. What I'd like to do is for everyone who is, for my guests and my participating audience who's still online, I'd like to make this announcement, and then I'll give each one of you 1 minute to make a final statement to our listening audience for tonight. But first and foremost, we'd like to alert our listening audience that you are listening to Brother Africa. That's Africa on the Move. This is a weekly program. You can reach us at the same time, same station, every Sunday evening from 7 to 9 p.m. So please share the word with your friends. Also, we'd like to alert you that this program is a community project under the African Awareness Association. You can reach us at African_Awareness_Association@Yahoo. We'd like to have your views and comments. As always, wherever there is economic dependency, there cannot be no freedom. This is a show where we speak truth to power. But at the same time, like all institutions, in order to exist and maintain, we need your support. We ask all our friends and supporters and people who value Africa on the Move if they can send in a contribution to support us so we can maintain our airways on the line. Make your donation contribution out to African Awareness Association, P.O. Box 4433, Richmond, Virginia, 23220. We need your support. Then closing up, we'll go down the line. We'll start with our guest. We'll start with Sister Namia. Can you just give us your final thoughts? 1 minute, please. Sister Namia, your final thoughts.
To hear the news from New York about how the youth are going across the world and getting that information and getting that interaction. And I also would like to agree with her on the fact that we need to get back to family and we need to get back to nurturing, because that's what it's all about. Any community is about family and about unity and togetherness. So I would just like the audience to really meditate on many things that the sister said. And I'm from New York, and I know very well the work of Queen Mother Moore. And onward and upward.
Thank you. Sister Sandy, your final thoughts. 1 minute, please, for tonight's program.
Okay. Tonight's program has been very interesting. I'm very thankful that I was able to give a little bit of my knowledge on Cuba, and it was well received. And I was very interested your first guest about the museum. That was a very interesting piece also, because I think it's all related. You know, we all need to know our history, regardless whether it's here in this country, in Cuba. We came from Africa and were dispersed all in the diaspora, and I think they all kind of, connect together.
Okay, we thank you. We'd like to make a note to our listening audience who may be listening to us online. You can please go to the archive to hear the entirety of our programs by going to www.blogtalkradio.com. www.com/Africa-on-the-move. You can listen to all the programs that we have done, including this one tonight, for the entirety. Okay, next we will go to our caller. Caller 9303. Your 1 minute statement, please. 9303.
Yes, sir. The final statement I'd like to make, Brother Shock again, and the final statement I'd like to make, sir, is that you know, you enhance your mind, you enhance your future. You know, we must get out, make our children stay in school and go to school, and make sure get the proper education. You know, and because you get the proper education, you prepare yourself today for the future. Because we live for the future, we live for the day, but we plan for the future. So all we got to prep and prepare ourselves, but let's prep and prepare our family to move on and forward in the future. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, brother. Again, Sister Queen Mother Delarice, your last statement, please. 1 minute, please.
I just want to say, in honor of Queen Mother Audley Moore, blessing to the family, and the legacy has been passed on to us. Long live the family.
We thank you. Sister, before you leave, is there any way one who may want to get in contact with you? How will they get in contact with you?
Queen Mother News, that's NEWS, Queen Mother News at gmail.com. Queen Mother News at gmail.com. Or call me at 212-368-3739. 212-368-3739. Peace.
Okay, and also, Sister Namia, is there a number or any way someone can get in contact with you or your organization?
Okay. Okay, they can contact me at my email, which is necessaryt@yahoo.com. That's necessaryt, the letter T, at yahoo.com.
Thank you, Sister Sandy. Is there any contact number or email where they can reach you?
Yes, they can be reached at sandywaters426@gmail.com.
Thank you, and we're going now to our brother Moses. Your last minute, 1 minute comment, please, Brother Moses.
Yes, thank you again. I think it's been a wonderful show. It's educate to liberate. We have to each one teach one, and it's a process. And I just think, you know, continue to struggle.
Thank you, Brother Moses. To our last and final participants for the night, Sister Hattie, your last statement to our audience. You have 1 minute, please.
Oh, a little bit quicker than that. I just wanted to say, sisters and brothers, thank all of you for carrying the torch for your work, and you will be in my prayers profusely to be healthy, to be strong, and to continue to doing what God has put you to do. And carrying your gifts forward.
Tonight you have been listening to Brother Africa and his special guests, Sister Sandy, Sister Nanamia, and Sister Queen Mother Galleries, as well as our audience. As always, it has been an honor to come into your homes in the evening where we can share information that we hope that has enlightened you to become a better person, to help you develop a better community and develop a better humanity. We come on every Sunday evening from 7 to 9. Please share that with your network. And also, this is a community project program of the African Awareness Association. You always can reach us at African_Awareness_Association@Yahoo. In order to speak poverty truth, in order to be independence, we must have our own economic base. We are appealing to the public. We are in need of your support. Send all contributions to African Awareness Association, P.O. Box 4433, Richmond, Virginia, zip code 23220. We speak as one voice, we act as one force, and we know that victory is certain. Until next time, we thank you all. And let's continue to listen and support Africa on the Move. We love you. We're going to struggle and tell our people it's easy free. But no.
Next week, same time, same place.
I love you.